You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Recently, we were joined by Tim Lang, Professor of Food Policy at the Centre for Food Policy, City University of London. Now, Tim has written extraordinarily perceptive articles and books about Britain's dysfunctional food system for years, and he shines a light into the darker sides of food politics, especially government sang-froid and short-sighted policy. Good example is that when he wrote to DEFRA recently proposing an expert committee on food and nutrition to work with SAGE, DEFRA said that nutrition was Public Health England's responsibility. Then Public Health England replied, well, the matter's actually for ministers to decide. Bizarre stuff. Now, Feeding Britain was published in March 2020, just 3 days after coronavirus lockdown began. I want to find out whether 4 months into a massive test of the British food system, Tim feels that anything's changed, and whether he thinks that the UK government will finally pull its finger out and tackle some of the big issues facing us all. Professor Tim Lang, thank you so much for joining us. For anyone who hasn't read your work, can you just start off by maybe attempting the impossible and give us a quick explanation of why you think Britain's food system is dysfunctional and how it arrived in this state?
Well, I don't just think it's dysfunctional. It's got some good things as well. So I'd like to make that to start with. I presume you're referring to my Feeding Britain book, which came out from Pelican just as Britain went into the lockdown. That was a book I set out, initially was asked to do about 8 years ago, but for all sorts of reasons only got down to properly 2 years ago. Obviously not expecting COVID-19 crisis to hit, but essentially it's a review of British food security, those two golden words. And the first thing I do is unpick, what do we mean by food security? Is it just bums on seats, enough tonnage of food coming in, or is it health consequences, capacity to cope with crisis and things like that? Is it food defense? Can you, as happened in World War One and World War Two, can you protect your food supplies? And I look at the complexity of what food needs to be in the 21st century and say, Britain ain't quite passing muster. We're doing some things quite well. The British have got more interested in food. It used to be famous for being sludge and brown sludge. And it's Europeanized. It's got more sophisticated. The range of foods that people eat. British children think pizza is their number one food and they think it's British. Actually, it isn't. So lots of interesting things have happened, but on stark measurements, does Britain feed itself? No, about 50%, depends how you measure it. If you include feedstuffs coming in, not even that. If you just say, well, only what we could grow here, well, not even that actually, only about 60, 70%. And if you look at inequalities, if you look at health outcomes, not good. So the first half of the book is about that, and the second half is saying, well, what do we need to do, and how can we unlock the lock-ins? What's stopping us dealing with this? And then I have a fifth of the book, a very big bit of it, of saying, you know, as a one-man royal commission sort of thing, daring to say what I think should happen.
Excellent. That's what we need, the solutions.
It is. I make 33 recommendations from that we actually need new legislation to ensure that our food is sustainable and healthy. And there's nothing at the moment other than the Climate Change Act that gives an imperative to that, through to what sort of guidance do we need, new system of guidance? Do we need more citizens' engagement, through to how can we improve food defence? I actually think one of the critical issues from my book has not quite yet been picked up. It's being picked up in intelligence and some defence circles, but not in the mass public. Put it this way, if geopolitics of China versus Russia versus the United States versus Europe got nasty, Britain's in really serious problems and can't protect itself.
Yeah, but you've been writing about these issues for years. I've been reading your incredibly perceptive articles for years. And you must be boiling with frustration that nothing is really changing. Or is that too simplistic? Do you think things are changing, but it's just not happening fast enough?
You can't see me, I'm nodding. I think it is too simplistic, if I may say so. Mm. I think a lot has changed. I think there's an enormous interest, and there's now even policy interest in food. In the banking crisis 2007-08, suddenly Britain, which, and the rich world, America too, the European, rich European countries too, suddenly woke up and said, oh my goodness, you know, food on world markets has just doubled in price because oil has doubled in price because the financial system's gone into meltdown. We've got to sort this out. And then there was actually a very interesting 3 years under a Labour government, where they started taking it seriously. And they'd been mainly free trading, saying, well, you know, leave this to the market. Something is now happening again under a Conservative government. They hate the European Union, so said, okay, get out of the European Union, it's all going to be perfect after that, and we'll just subsidize our farmers to look after the environment. And people like me said, food? Isn't farming about food? Isn't British land maybe something about food? And Michael Gove, because it was him, Secretary of State, said, oh my goodness, and immediately appointed fast food entrepreneur Henry Dimbleby to come in and try and do something. And Dimbleby's a good man and very thoughtful, but he was parked, then brought back in, then parked, and is now back in. So, but I think we're going to get a national food strategy, but it's being hemmed in by the new so-called global Britain, but also very insular Britain. So we don't quite know what's going to happen, but of course I'm hopeful. So there is engagement. To answer your question, but it comes and goes. And one of the things in my Feeding Britain book I do is give my readers a potted history of how we got into this. Well, the answer, it goes back a couple of hundred years and more. Britain is an imperialist country where we could just say, as we did in 1846 with the repeal of the Corn Laws, well, we won't bother to feed ourselves. We'll just get our empire to feed us. Mm. But today there isn't an empire, actually. And so, you know, the government and food companies say, well, we'll trade it. Really? How much? Let's get clear about this, is what I say. Well, is it good to be only 50% self-sufficient? Does it matter? I think it does, actually. I think you're risky. I think you can't defend it. I think it's using other people's land. And when you look at where Britain gets its food, it's using land, labour and water. And we don't want to use ours. Well, why? We've actually got very fertile land. We've got lots of people. We're rich. We're very divided, but we're rich. Why aren't we taking our own food system more seriously? So there is a real history to this about an assumption that let others feed us.
But and this brings us on to my main question here, really, is so you published the book 3 days after coronavirus lockdown began on the 23rd of March. Has the lockdown, I think that the food industry would probably say that it didn't collapse and it coped surprisingly well with the pressures and the strains. Now, you level your guns a little bit at the just-in-time supply chain and the weaknesses of the supply chain, but they say that they would say it didn't collapse. Is that the case, or are the disasters that you've pointed out to us in the book hidden to our eyes?
I don't point out disasters because you can say from a British point of view, it isn't a complete disaster. Hmm. Well, it depends how you define what you want. If you want people to be healthy, it is a disaster. We're obese. We've got a catastrophic burden on the National Health Service from diet-related disease. There is a massive inequalities between the richest and the poorest in Britain, and diet's a major factor in that. And the ecosystems damage caused by the food system. I confess, when I really got back into it, and this was the first time for about 45 years, I've only looked at my own country. Mm. I was genuinely shocked, if I can say, really shocked at the massive destruction of biodiversity associated with agrochemical use and things like that. So, but I don't think it's all a disaster. There's more interest. There's beginning some engagement. It isn't just as it was in the 1930s or indeed in the 1880s or the 1910s of just massive food poverty. We've got some food poverty, but we've got some food excellence. We've got some agricultural deserts. And we've got some islands of really good ecological practice. How can we rebalance that and recalibrate it is what I'm really saying. Dear Britain, I think it's time we woke up. And dear Britain, there are some processes we can get involved in, like the Dimbleby National Food Strategy, like the anti-obesity strategy. There's no good, just as the Prime Minister said in a former occasion, to blame fat people for it's their own fat fault, he said. Well, he was 17 and a half stone when he went into COVID-19 and he didn't do particularly well. Mm. But to get back to COVID-19, I think it's only worked well because 9 companies were basically given carte blanche. The government closed down food service. 2 million jobs went into abeyance. They could have been feeding hubs. They could have been community hubs. The Prime Minister's hero, Winston Churchill, that's what they did. They made community hubs. And you've seen in some areas around the country, in cities and towns and rural areas, where a bit of community hub feeding has emerged, despite support rather than because of it.
And now we speak to Joe Churchill, MP, Minister for Prevention, Public Health and Primary Care. Welcome to the podcast, Joe.
Thank you very much.
Now, the new obesity strategy has perhaps unsurprisingly been met with a fair amount of disapproval from the food industry. It's been condemned by the Food and Drink Federation, the Advertising Association and Institute of Economic Affairs, City University Centre for Food Policy, even Action on Sugar and Action on Salt said it's a missed opportunity. Now, I guess you can't please everyone and everyone does want to make positive changes, but were you expecting this kind of reaction?
I think when you try and instigate change, there is a difficult path. For some, it's too much, and for some, it's not enough. So what we tried to do was make sure that there was a raft of measures to help get the nation fit and healthy. And really, I suppose the laser focus for this was COVID. I mean, we know that in this country, we have about 2/3 of the population who are overweight or living with obesity. And we know that the effects on individuals during the crisis, for those who were in that bracket, the risk of hospitalization was greater and the trajectory of the disease was more difficult. And we've also known for a long time that there's many other health areas where it impacts quite challengingly on people's quality of life. So around diabetes, many cancers have a link to carrying too much weight and so on. So actually designing a raft of measures, including banning unhealthy food adverts, the ending of buy one, get one free promotions, calorie labelling, both on food, but also looking at consulting on it on alcohol calorie labelling, expanding the NHS services and front of pack nutritional labelling, add to the ambitions in chapter 1, 2 and 3 of the obesity strategy for halving the rate of childhood obesity by 2030. And I think they should be seen in the round. We're not saying to anyone that you can't have something. What we're trying to do, and what I would love the industry to look at this through, is the lens of opportunity. Because actually, we want to give people the ability to make healthier choices. We want to empower them. We want to give them making a healthy choice an easy choice. And let's be frank, if we'd been such a cracking success at it so far, we wouldn't, as a nation, be one of the heaviest.
Now, what are the targets and how are they going to be quantified?
We've set the most ambitious targets in the world, and what success will look like is halving that childhood obesity by 2030 and making a generational change. Because we've already, I mean, I suppose the cutting of sugar from half of the drinks on sale, when that was introduced, and sugar in drinks has dropped by 28.8% reduction.
Although overall sugar consumption has gone up.
Oh, indeed it has. But what I think you have to do, as I say, is look at this as a suite of things, because the SIDL shows that you can do it. So you've got companies like Lucozade reduce the average sugar content of their entire portfolio by 50%. Their existing core and new drinks now sit below the SIDL threshold. We sell more drinks. Everybody said the market would contract, but it didn't. There's been a 5% uplift on it. There is more sugar being consumed, which shows why we have to think about the suite of interventions and helping educate people in those high fat, high salt sugar products, you know, to ensure that you can make a better choice. Because we also know that there are family linkages, and the children who have a parent in the household who carries too much weight or lives with obesity is much more likely to they themselves struggle with their weight. And that affects so many things in a children's life.
I think that there are certain things in there that I'm very excited by. I think alcoholic drinks featuring calorie labeling is fantastic. Or not that that's going to really impact childhood obesity, I guess. But there are some things. But overall, I think there's a general feeling that it's not a particularly original or dynamic approach to tackling obesity. That it's an extension of things that have already been done. It's relatively negative about certain foods rather than finding a way to be positive about healthy diets and a better health campaign to help people lose weight. I'm not sure if there's one that's quantifiably been very successful in the past. What are the things that you think in this raft of suggestions, of features of the strategy, are most likely to have an effect?
I think it's the sum of its parts. So a little like you don't see the picture when you put the jigsaw box on the table, but slowly you get the picture on the front of the box. I would agree with you in part. And shall I tell you where I think the real opportunity for the food industry is? For them to be innovative in this space, because actually banning unhealthy food adverts is something that has been demanded for a long time. We have looked to go further than what was previously asked for, and we're consulting on actually moving into the online space as well, because we know that this generation that's coming along actually digests its screen time in a very different way. We know that ending buy one, get one free promotions, we know from the evidence that people, and let's be frank, it's why if I was running a retail outlet, I would use them, because we know that people are attracted to them and they buy two of the products. But we also know that invariably they're the high sugar, high fat products that are put on promotion. We know that people don't put them in the cupboard and save them for another day. We know that they eat them, which obviously increases their calorie consumption. So actually, it's not doing what we need it to do. What about, Stefan, if those buy one, get one free type of offers were on healthy food?
Absolutely.
Why aren't they? Because that would be exciting.
Is that something that you think that you can achieve? Is that another phase of the question? Because I don't think it's part of the strategy at the moment.
But I think you have to see this as a journey. And perhaps for any cyclists out there, if you imagine these pieces are each individual separate parts of a bicycle. So we now have a very basic framework, an ambitious framework for a racing bike, but we will add other things to it. And the expansion of the NHS services, the highlighting of driving more individuals to get help with diabetes, all these things, you can well throw at us the criticism that they are the same as what's been talked about before, but actually the ambition to deliver has never been stronger, And there are new parts of the strategy, and there are new ways of empowering people. And, you know, the industry talks a lot about its social responsibility. I think this is a good time to look at what they do in this space and help consumers to help themselves. A fitter nation in GDP terms actually adds the most enormous amount to the British economy. Those individuals actually are your key workers, are your workers in your organizations. How good would it be for us all if we were just carrying a little bit less weight that gave us a little better quality of life and allowed us to do the things we want to do?
I think everyone knows that this has to be tackled. I wonder, have you done analysis on the expected impact on the industry, and what is that? So have you looked at the costs to manufacturers and retailers of these measures?
No, I haven't at this stage. But I am very mindful that I was told that, SIDL would impact detrimentally. I was told that we couldn't possibly look at not advertising. But we've seen on Trailblazers, working with local authorities, that actually affecting the environment has a huge effect on how people consume and shop and so on. So again, I would slightly throw it back to the industry. People during lockdown purchase food. There were very few, I have a largest family, there were very few offers of any of these types going on during lockdown. It was perfectly possible to ensure that people could access, and that is a huge credit to the industry, that people had access to food, both fresh and on the shelf, throughout the crisis.
Now, some people seem to be very curious about the fact that there haven't been any mandatory targets on reformulation of food. And I wonder, why has that not been part of the strategy?
Reformulation is something that we would rather the industry looked at and actually took forward themselves before we have to drive reformulation forward. There are some areas where I think we could be doing better. As I say, overall tons of sugar sold in foods in the reformulation program in the in-home sector, or as you said, actually increased, whereas the sugar sold in soft drinks decreased. So there may well be a need for more definition around reformulation, but this ambitious strategy, and it is ambitious, lays the way to, or puts the direction of travel in that we want to go. I mean, Kellogg's reduced the amount of sugar in its top three selling children's cereals, including Cocoa Pops, between 20 and 40% last year. Now, lots of supermarkets, lots of manufacturers within the industry have already started to look at reformulation. This is the direction of travel. So I am expecting that industry will look at both what the consumer is demanding, because we know that during the lockdown, there has been a change in consumer behaviours. There's been a trend in home cooking, trend in looking at health products and immunity products when you are looking at what you feed your family. We are seeing people eat more healthily, and a third of people eating more fruit and veg since the outbreak. Now, those and the combination of people planning to cook from scratch, I think brands have a huge opportunity to help facilitate cooking from home more.
Now, Ahead of the COP26 climate talks in Glasgow coming in November 2021, the UK's announced intentions to cut carbon emissions by 78% by 2035. In December 2020, a whole range of ambitious targets were set in the UK's sixth carbon budget. If we achieve it, we will be three quarters of the way to net zero by 2050. The carbon emission cuts are coming across many industries: aviation, shipping, construction. But we're going to look at just one aspect that's mentioned: reducing meat and dairy consumption by 20%. With me to discuss this are Chris Venables, Head of Politics from the Green Alliance. Hello, Chris.
Good morning. Hi.
And Dr. Michael Clark, researcher, Nuffield Department of Population Health at the University of Oxford. Hello, Michael.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
It was great to have you both here. Now, just a couple of general things first of all. Chris, reading the CCC's recommended pathway looks extraordinarily ambitious. I mean, almost naively so as I read through it. It's just so positive. It's so exciting. I read it and go, that's fantastic. Do you think it's really feasible to reduce our carbon emissions by 78% by 2035 or to net zero by 2050?
Yes, resoundingly so. I mean, I guess one of the amazing things that we have here in the UK is the Committee on Climate Change. It sounds quite boring, but it really isn't, because it's this group of people who get to sit down and think about how we do this mammoth task. And it is a mammoth task, and I agree with you on that. But they get to talk to experts, academics, people doing the work, and they come up with a really credible, evidence-based way of saying, there's a really ambitious target, but here's how we get there. And so I read that, and I trust in their kind of million spreadsheets and long reports, and I think, yes, we can absolutely do it. And yeah, so yes is the answer to that question, kind of very simply.
Okay, well, that's really exciting. That's an exciting start, And we'll get to the nuts and bolts of it in a minute, which might get a little bit trickier. now, Mike, the Prime Minister recently announced revision of targets up to 78%. Now, is this the mark of a Prime Minister who's simply making a jolly announcement he won't have to see through? Or is there the political will and funding and regulation to back it up? I mean, you know, we know that it's timely that there was a new coal mine just given the go ahead and the scrapping of the Green Homes Grant. Is it just a jolly idea, or do you think we can genuinely do it?
Yeah, so I agree with Chris on this. I definitely think we can do this. That being said, we really need to start today if we actually are serious about meeting that 78% reduction target. The one thing that's going to be really important to kind of balance is the fact that we're facing climate targets, but also need to keep essentially economic systems and cultural values in the back of our mind. And whoever's in charge of balancing those is in a position I do not personally envy too much.
Well, that's, I guess, and that brings us on to this podcast. Now, we're very much aimed at people interested in the business of food. Now, the cutting meat and dairy consumption by a fifth, 20%, probably is an exciting idea, but terrifies a lot of people in farming and in food. Do you think that 20%, Chris, is 20% the right amount? Is this a considered idea, or have they just thrown this out there as a dream?
Well, I think the starting point for all of this, in my mind, is that, you know, based upon, you know, the work of world scientists in October 2018, if we want to meet the 1.5 degree goal, we have to reduce emissions across the global economy by half by 2030. And like that's your kind of starting point. Like, and that isn't a kind of like, oh, you know, that would be nice. It's a really serious thing, you know. And like, if you get into, as I do, if you kind of read about the impacts of climate change every day, it's not really a pretty picture. It's quite depressing, it's sad, and it's like, and so it really motivates you to kind of think what would be possible. So just to turn to the 20% piece, I think that's perfectly possible. I mean, I think it's also worth saying that agricultural emissions in the UK are kind of one of the sectors that has kind of crept up as others have crept down. And so it's one of those kind of sectors that we really need to kind of turn a laser focus to and work out at quite a systemic level how we change things. And I don't think that's about saying to anyone, oh, you're wrong, don't eat meat. You know, that's about saying kind of what's going on with our supermarkets, kind of what's, you know, how can we support farmers to do stuff differently? How can we educate people to understand about the food system and kind of make the changes in a way that feels like it could be fun and good. And I can say a bit about my own personal story on that as well. You know, so, yeah.
I bet you could. I bet you could. Yeah, hold on with that. So, but first of all, so what's interesting is I think you touched on a couple of things here. There are two different things. There are the production methods. There is agriculture and its emissions, and the potential ability to cut those emissions. And then there's consumption on the other side. So there are two. I mean, there are lots of different issues to this, but those are two major factors. Do you think there is potential in cutting carbon emissions, but to some extent not cutting 20% of the production of meat and dairy?
Well, I look to Mike as I think the expert on this, but my strong understanding is that you can't. You really have to reduce how much high carbon, you know, food products we're eating across the board. That said, we also know, you know, a third of food across the globe is wasted between kind of farm and fork. So there's all kinds of ways of reducing our impact. But as part of that quite big package of things, you have to look at meat and dairy, and you have to look at how much we're eating. And I love a bacon sandwich as much as anyone, but you know, I can't have one every day, or you know, like, you know, there's things we're gonna have to look at. We do have to reduce what we're eating, but I don't think it's this kind of big drastic no be anymore kind of thing. It's just kind of slight shift.
Okay, so Mike, what's your opinion on this? I mean, you know, we could be feeding cattle, insects, and things like that in order to reduce the greenhouse gas embedded emissions. But do you think it really also needs to come down to consumption?
Yes, absolutely. So I'll start with a broader perspective, real quick. So if you look at a global scale, so Chris was mentioning this very briefly, but if you look at a global scale right now, agriculture and food production systems emit about a third of global greenhouse gas emissions. And so I think it's important to iterate that, because we don't, most individual society perspective, when we think about climate change, we think about fossil fuels. But if you look at agriculture, that's a third of the driver behind climate change at a global perspective. And if you narrow down into livestock, so meat and dairy, that accounts for about anywhere between a third to a half of agricultural emissions. So if you stick that back into that global perspective, producing animals for either meat or dairy accounts for about somewhere between 10 to 15% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And so that kind of brings us to the question that you're asking, where if we reduce that chunk by 20%, what does that mean in the context of these climate targets? And so I'm very much in the mindset that it's kind of two different things. So if we're talking about places like the UK, where there's a general history of overconsumption, both in terms of just food in general, but also meat and dairy in specific, is that places like that are going to need to reduce consumption of meat and dairy, probably reduce consumption of other things too. I'll get back to that in a second, and need to do that relatively rapidly. So most indications from papers, from research in the last 2 to 3 years indicate that in countries like the UK, consumption of red meat, so pork and beef and mutton and goat, and the consumption of poultry collectively need to reduce probably about 75% if we're actually serious to meet these climate targets. And so from that perspective, 20% reduction in meat and dairy is a start, but it isn't going to get us to where we need to be. The complicated aspect of this is that it's also going to be very context specific. And so if you go to a different country that may not have as much access to meat, may have a lot of food insecurity, and you go to people within that country and say, hey, look, you need to reduce your meat consumption, and they already don't get enough food, that isn't really something that you want to be doing. It's not fair. It's not equitable. It's not just. It very well could be killing people if you communicate it that way. And so in places like the UK, a 20% reduction isn't going to be anywhere close to enough. But in places where underconsumption is prevalent, eating more is probably better for the people. And even if it may not be quite ideal in the climate perspective, we do need to focus on the people before we start targeting these environmental problems that we're facing.
Now, obviously, the farming industry, agriculture, and a lot of the food industry would say, well, what you're dealing with here is not just a target, but also about culture, economics, lifestyle, and that will, you know, that will be impacted by all of these things. Should people just brace themselves and take what's coming to them, or is there a way to deal with this that is constructive?
That's a fantastic question. I'll take it then. So I think one of my friends, Jess Renzella, has said this a few times, and I think it's kind of, we're at the point where we need to think about what we're willing to give up. And so if we are serious about meeting either a climate target or biodiversity targets or water scarcity targets, we really need to think about what are we willing to give up to meet that. And so right now, in the context of what we're talking about, are we willing to give up meat and dairy, maybe give up some other foods or reduce consumption to meet those targets? If we don't reduce meat and dairy, it means we have to do something else more ambitiously. But it's kind of, it's going to be different by person, it's going to be different by country, by, again, context. But we have to think, we really do need to think about what are we actually willing to do to meet these targets on both an individual level and a society-wide level.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, I mean, I suppose I spend a lot of my time working at the political level. So you know, spend a lot of time talking to MPs, to ministers, to, you know, at a government. And I think, you know, we're at quite an exciting point in the UK in that regard, because we left the EU, because we are kind of in the process of redesigning our agricultural support payments. Yeah, there is quite a big potential to look, you know, like 10, 15 years ahead and just think about how we do that. So I don't think it has to be this big kind of like U-turn or big kind of, you know, shift to the, you know, kind of stop and drive into direction. But I think there are some really good plans in place to start, you know, like changing how we spend that kind of £3 billion every year, you know, of taxpayers' money at supporting, you know, kind of our farms across the UK. And you'll know better than me probably, but, you know, that there's all kinds of new schemes that are being set up just to kind of shift how those payments work. And so I think it's as much about kind of, and I think that's the beauty of the targets in a way, is that, you know, 2030 is kind of long enough away that you can start to think, well, how do we get there? And what do we do, you know, and so I think, so that feels quite exciting to me. And I think it's on all of us to change what we do individually, but also just to kind of ask up, you know, and you know, that the government is in a position of power to really shift at those things in a way that's happened in the electricity system. You know, we've basically decarbonized our electricity system, you know, through kicking coal off the electricity grid. If you ask those people, yeah, they don't have a clue that's happened. And so there are these ways of kind of, you know, changing the structures of our economy without being really disruptive.
Well, Dr. Mike Clark and Chris Venables, thank you so much for filling us in about the details of these incredibly important issues. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from indulgence to controlling our appetite. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thanks for listening.